From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is more of a disconnection, a fractured community with a serious challenge to overcome. Here's the story. In the greater Rochester area, people of color are doing much, much worse than the national average. A new report titled Hard Facts lays out the numbers in detail after detail. Whites are more than twice as likely to own a home as African Americans and Latinos. African American households are making less than half of what white households are making. African Americans and Latinos are more than three times as likely to live in poverty compared to whites. And we're talking a nine-county region, not just the city of Rochester. And this is not what our local leaders envision, but it is our reality. The report comes from ACT Rochester, and the author of the report is our guest for the hour. He is the author of a number of recent reports in recent years as we look at poverty in our region, as we look now at some of the racial disparities on outcomes. Ed Doherty, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Well, and it starts with this that understanding that I want to make sure our listeners understand, not just the city of Rochester.
Absolutely.
This time, right?
This is a report that looks at data for the nine-county region surrounding Monroe and the surrounding eight counties. It does not look specifically at city of Rochester data.
Okay. What did you set out to try to find with this work, Ed?
Well, ACT Rochester has been tracking this data for a number of years and putting out very short reports in tabular form. So the data has been known sort of to a small circle of people within the community. And ACT Rochester asked me, and I agreed as a volunteer, to put it into a context of a narrative report. So we took data that's updated annually and is, in fact, available on the ACT Rochester website on an updated basis regularly into this narrative form. You know, it's not fun looking at the dark side of the community. I mean, this is a great community. It really is. I have been cast in the role sort of looking at the hard facts, the negatives. But the truth is I think that Rochester will be a really great community when it can look at this kind of data and say, all right, we understand the realities. Let's figure out where we go from here. Three general conclusions from the report. First, for African Americans and Latinos, for those two groups specifically, the disparities as compared to Caucasians, to whites in our community, are dramatic. Second conclusion, those disparities are greater here than in the nation, and we can get into some detail on that.
Yep.
And then the third is really that this hurts the community, the entire region, that we can quantify some of the impacts that these disparities have on our region in terms of not sharing the prosperity and the good fortune that exists more generally among our full community.
When you put a report out like this, is it your hope that the people with the power to make change will grab onto it to understand it better? Are those policymakers, elected leaders, someone else? What's the hope here?
Well, it's certainly the entire community. You know, we have a specific history of what's happened since we put out some of the poverty data a few years back and the kinds of mobilization that could occur with that. But I think that the data is intended to inform everybody. I think that there is a tendency in the Rochester community to somehow think that, well, we're doing a little better than others because we certainly do excel in some areas. But in terms of wealth and educational opportunity, health and well-being, home ownership, as you mentioned, being available equitably, we're not doing better. We're doing more poorly.
We are not a community that carries the moniker equal opportunity community right now.
I think that's certainly, it's abundantly clear. We certainly, going into and looking at this data, understood that given American history and American society, that disparities existed. But I'm not sure we expected that they'd be that dramatic, that household incomes for African Americans would actually be less than half the level they are for whites in our region. I mean, that's a dramatic disparity.
How does that compare with, you know, either statewide, national?
Well, the national level is about 62%. So nationally, African Americans earn about 62% as compared to white incomes. Here, it's less than half. So that's a very, very
dramatic,
meaningful difference. And by the way, you can quantify that number. You know, that I took a quick stab at that and put the African-American Latino number. You're talking about close to $750 million in annual income that is the differential between what African-Americans and Latinos are earning in our region versus what they would if they were at the national averages. So that's pretty significant.
Oh, amazing.
Now, I know all the economists out there are saying, no, it's not a zero-sum game. That's somebody else. And that's probably true. But let's imagine a different community. Let's imagine a community where those communities that I'm talking about had more wealth. What would it be like? Would it, and when I say more wealth, I'm talking about only the disparity levels that exist nationwide.
Which is still a problem.
Which is still a huge problem. Exactly. What would our community look like? Would there be more activity? Would there be more economic activity? Would we have, I don't know what it would be. You know, I'm not an African American, so I can't say it would be jazz clubs and it would be different types of clothing stores, but it would be something. And I think that's important for us to recognize that this has a big economic impact on our community.
Ed Doherty, my guest for the hour. Listeners, if you want to call the program with questions or comments as we work through his new report, Hard Facts, Race and Ethnicity in the 9-County Greater Rochester Area, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Before I move forward on some of the details, let me ask you a broader question, because Ed is someone who knows and cares about history, occasionally lectures and talks to groups about in our community. I look at things like what's going on in Charlottesville. I look at the way people are feeling. And some people right now are thinking, well, it's never been this bad, or this is the worst it's been in a century. And then others who are maybe a little older than those posting on social media saying, no, I remember the mid to late 60s. You know, it feels terrible now. It is in many ways. It's still not the mid to late 60s. Is it worth contextualizing and comparing that? How does it feel to you right now?
It's a good question, and I can only give you sort of an off-the-cuff impression on that. I think it is certainly qualitatively different than the height of the civil rights movement in the mid-60s, but there are some clear parallels. The experience in the United States, especially over the last 30 years, which has been one of more centralization of wealth, more wealth
concentration.
Concentration up at the upper end. And, you know, sooner or later, people react to that. And so we have conditions that are out there now that are more economic, perhaps, than racial, as they were back before we had laws that outlawed the kinds of overt discrimination that were legal prior to the mid-60s. But nonetheless, you get that kind of frustration that occurs to people when they see more wealth being concentrated. I heard a statistic just earlier today about how, you know, if you look at the minimum wage in the United States and correct it for inflation, it's gone down. I mean, that's a scary thought. So in the national context, I think that there's some good parallels, but we have to understand that there's some qualitative differences as well. Now, this report wants us to really look locally as opposed to focusing just on those societal kinds of questions and ask the question, are there things that we can do here in our own region?
Are there solutions in our grasp?
There are. They're not easy. They're not fast. They're not popular in many cases. You know, I've had some experience in trying to diversify a workforce. I spent 20 years leading one of the largest city departments, a very diverse city department, and I was charged with improving the diversity especially among the management staff there. We had some success. We had some failures. I want to be clear about that. But the challenges are instructive. You can't get a more diverse workforce, have more people of color at higher levels in the organization, management levels, without a real detailed plan, real support from upper management, real support from management throughout the organization, and intelligent strategies. And that's where this whole question of, you know, is this about race or is it about racism? And, you know, I tried in the report very much to stay away from using the word racism until the very end, where we talk about what structural racism is. And in some ways, the results of this report almost perfectly mimic the classic definition of racial
structural racism. Give it for our listeners. And by the way, I see the phone ringing. We're going to get to your phone calls in a second here. But why don't you give us that definition as you
put
it together?
Well, probably the most popular definition that's used is the one that comes from the Aspen Institute. Now, I'll just read it. A system in which public policies, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other norms work in various, often reinforcing ways to perpetuate racial group inequity. And so I think that what we're saying here is that given these inequities, it seems inevitable that we have a significant issue of structural racism. There are other forms of racism. There's the individual racism that people engage in when they make generalities, they make decisions at hiring. And I've heard some of these over my career. I mean, there's plenty of individual racism out there. I've heard them. We don't need to hire another African-American. We have one. That kind of thing sounds almost mild, but think about what the impact of a statement like that really is.
Doesn't sound mild to me.
Right, exactly. And institutional racism, which is where racism is sort of reinforced by institutional policies, practices, and realities. Very significant. Anything that, you know, if you have inequity and you have systems that maintain the status quo, then those systems will, by definition, become forms of institutional racism. I'm talking about things like everything from seniority rules to civil service rules to all manner of things that are built into our system that frequently preclude people of color to be able to advance and fully take advantage of the economy of our society.
All right, so if we're going to find a way to make, you know, diversity of employment happen, encouraging, as you told City Newspaper, system-wide diversity of employment. You know, if you were called in to consult with a company that really wanted to do it intentionally, mm-hmm. and not mm-hmm. just do it in a way that is this perfunctory, we're trying to check a box.
Right.
We really care about this, which also means management, executive-level mm-hmm. decision-making, real diversity at every level. Where can we start?
Well, okay, start with information and data, okay? If, in fact, your management team is representative of what our local market says it should be in terms of its representation of people of color, then you're done. Don't worry about this so much. Now, I say that because very, very few
almost no one is
will, in fact, find that.
Right.
So the opposite's true. If it's not, then you're, in essence, discriminating. Even though you don't feel like you're discriminating, you are, because you should be representative of the data that you can collect that shows where you ought to be in terms of representation in our local market. The next thing is, if you do have that data and you truly want to make a change in how you operate, you got to get your management team on board. They've got to see why this is important, why it's valuable, why it's a good thing to do, not just for society, but for your company's long-term viability, for your ability to meet customer needs, for your ability to improve the local economy, frankly.
And there's data that supports that, right?
There's a ton of data that supports that. And again, I have personal experience with following an approach like this. Unfortunately, it was called affirmative action. And everybody misunderstands affirmative action, and they think that it means something different, generally. They see it as meaning quotas and so forth, whereas affirmative action actually, in its essence, an affirmative action system means figuring out where you are, setting your goals, and figuring out what affirmative actions you will take to meet those goals.
Okay, so that's one of the possible solutions that Ed sees out there. As we go throughout the hour, we're going to hear more of his ideas, and we'll get into more of the data. Let's take some of your phone calls here. 844-295-TALK. Dee in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Dee.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call. I work with people with developmental disabilities, and I'm out in the community a lot. And what I see is a lack of diversity at entertainment that we have in the city, like Seabreeze or sport events or concerts, and it's probably due to lack of money, lack of transportation. And if you don't have this stuff in your life, it brings a lot of joy to your life, and I notice it all the time, the lack of brown skin and black skin children at these events. And I'm just like, why aren't these tickets for free more often? You know, why aren't we filling these stadiums with just kids that just want to do something in the city? Like, who's advocating for the children just to have a happy lifestyle? Like, I don't understand how Rochester is not better than it is. I notice it every day, and I put it in my mind, like, why am I noticing this more than other people, that there's not many people here at Seabreeze today that are black or brown-skinned people? And that was just my comment. It just disappoints me that another population does not get to enjoy what I get to enjoy as a white woman.
Dee, thanks for the phone call. I think a couple of things, we'll let Ed respond to that as well. First of all, I certainly don't want anyone to think that anyone is saying that that there aren't wealthy, well-to-do people from all different racial backgrounds. Yes, there are, of course. But we are speaking generally based on what the data shows us. So some of what Dee is saying is, number one, why don't we see more stadium sporting events, sea breezes, reach out, offer free tickets, et cetera, the joy that comes from that. That's certainly up to those institutions, and I understand what Dee is saying there. I think what we should be asking is, how come there is a disparity, generally speaking, about who can afford that kind of thing? And so what Dee is seeing, Ed, is just an example in her own day-to-day life, anecdotally, of what the report is reflecting.
Yeah, I think that's accurate, Evan. As I said, if you have a group of people that's earning half the level of another group of people, you're going to see a lot fewer instances of people spending that income in and around the community, and that's certainly going to be reflected in a lot of places. You know, as part of this, I've tried to ask some hard questions like, you know, what is it about Rochester that's different? And I think one of the things is, you know, we talked about this when we talked about poverty, our ability to concentrate our poor people into one area. And we cannot equate race and poverty. That's a big mistake if we do that. So I'm not doing that. But we have a similar pattern with the way in which people of color live in our community. We are a more segregated community than most, considerably, based on current recent data. And so it is, to some extent, an out-of-sight, out-of-mind kind of thing, although when we venture out to some venue, we may touch upon what we think we should see in the world, and sometimes, as the caller indicated, it just isn't like that.
All right, and so before I grab the next phone call, again, what Ed is saying is, don't equate race with poverty, but in Rochester, redlining in particular helped affect a community living situation that saw a concentration of segregated communities that has not shifted. And I think, Ed, you've said before, a lot of communities, especially in the North, Northeast, had that. But in the 1980s, it started to shift a little with different policies, different approaches. And in Rochester, it sort of never did, right?
Well, that's a good point, Evan. Certainly, you know, redlining, which was a policy of deliberately steering people of different races and backgrounds to specific areas, is an illegal policy today, and so, you know, shouldn't be happening. But on the other hand, so much of our community had been developed, so much of the zoning regulations that had been that are currently in place had been either begun to be cast into place or were in fact in place at that time. We find very little rental property outside the city. We find almost no affordable housing outside the city. So we are living with those historical patterns for sure.
I know I've brought this up before, but I'm going to bring it up again since we're on it. We've heard political leaders say, well, we've talked to people who live in poverty. They don't want to move. They want to have more opportunity in their neighborhood, but they don't want to move. We can't just break up communities and sort of shuffle the deck that way. That's not what people want. What do you say to that? I know you've heard that.
Well, I have heard that, and I agree with that fully. I mean, nobody should be forced to move. People should live where they want to live. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence out there that if people were given a broader choice, they might make some different decisions than they're actually making. But that's really not the only question that we need to be asking. We need to be asking, how do the policies that we develop, both in government as well as the policies that our economy kind of dictates, how do these policies affect the long-term viability of our community. If we're locking people out of areas, we're discriminating against them. And so I think that if we want to create a situation where people have complete, free, open choice as to where to live, I'm all for it.
Okay. Let's grab our next phone call, Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a chance to actually download the hard facts report, and I thought it was kind of interesting. I did a word search on it. I searched for the word marriage, and I also searched for the word family, and I didn't find either word in the document. It's kind of interesting because there's no mention of family structure, and there's some very big differences by ethnicity for family structure in Monroe County. The percentage of single parent families by race and ethnicity, according to ACT Rochester's own website, is in the Asian community is only 18%. For Hispanics, it's 67%. For Blacks, it's 78%, and for Whites, it's 31%. You mentioned that some people by ethnicity are earning half of what they would other households would. That makes sense if there's only one person in the household that's in a capacity to earn money versus two people that would be married and earning money.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Ed?
I think that's excellent data. It sounds about right from what I'm hearing. This report, of course, didn't attempt to look at that variable. It did. Some of the poverty work that we've done earlier has been very clear that household structure, especially single parent households, is a significant factor relating to poverty. So I think that data is essentially accurate, or at least it rings true, mm-hmm. The data that the caller was mentioning. I don't dispute that.
Okay. Is that part of the conversation separately going forward, Ed? I mean,
well, in the poverty initiative work that's going on, there's an effort to try to continue to go deeper in understanding what the issues are with poverty. I think the early emphasis of the initiative is on what we would think of as low-hanging fruit, helping more people to access employment quickly, because, you know, you want to do what you can do quickly. I've made presentations on these issues across the community, and family structure is often brought up by questioners. And I always say, okay, how do we do that? And how do we change that? What is it that's causing what here? Why do we have the kinds of realities that the caller just mentioned? And if we're going to address those, we have to address them by asking those kinds of deep questions. But they're very, very valid questions.
I'm going to try to be careful, but I'm going to just kind of, this is part of the dialogue, right? This is not based on any expertise. I'm just going to ask out loud. If a population, generally speaking, is more likely to experience poverty and struggle in that way, is that population more likely to have kids who grow up to have different struggles, either with teen pregnancy, crime, unemployment, et cetera? In other words, is it logical that given the treatment in this country of African Americans, mm-hmm. populations of color, especially African Americans. Now, Robert might say, well, let's take a look at the difference between Asians, Latino, African Americans. I don't have the expertise to talk about that. But should we be all that surprised, given decades of redlining, of housing discrimination, of outright racism and discrimination, that there are legacy problems in this?
Well, that's true. I mean, and there's been much written in the national literature on that, the whole legacy of the impact of various policies on families of color. And, you know, we as a society have attempted to address those issues in some ways over the years, with a change here, a change there. But the truth is we are still living a very, very deep legacy. And so that's true. So the question is what do we do about it here and now?
Yeah.
And that's where our choices are somewhat limited. The best example of what you were describing, I think, is what we're seeing in our schools, where, you know, while we don't like the conditions we have today in terms of the disparate realities, they certainly can't be expected to get better given what we're seeing in terms of academic performance in our schools today. And not only are those disparities among the races, but again, the numbers for the Rochester region as compared to the statewide numbers are unbelievable. The disparities are dramatic, with students here of color having unfortunately significantly lower academic success. We got to ask ourselves how that could be, and I don't really know the answer to that one.
Ed's got a couple of other ideas that are possible solutions. I want to get to those in our second half hour. Anthony in Pittsford will take your call as well. Listeners, if you want to call the program, we're talking about the new report from Ed Doherty and ACT Rochester called Hard Facts, Race and Ethnicity in the 9-County Greater Rochester Area. Not just the city of Rochester, the 9-County area. And the facts show that for Latinos and African Americans, the results are much worse here than they are statewide and across the country, much worse in just about every category, and that we have to be honest with ourselves about the community that we're living in and what it means for us. And so Ed's report grapples with that in different ways. We're going to talk more about other possible solutions. Get your comments and questions if you have them for the report. Again, 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, end-of-life care. What is appropriate? What options should adults have? What options should we have for family members? We'll talk about the Charlie Gard case and a lot more in our first hour. Second hour, it is the end of the Summer of Food on Connections, and we take you out to El Pilon in Rochester. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me grab Anthony in Pittsford, who just has a question on what the study did and did not include. Go ahead, Anthony.
Hi. I was just wondering if the report mentions anything about Native Americans and Asians. That was my first question. And my second question is it possible to draw a correlation between the poverty rates of the way things are now and the exodus of industry that's gone on in Rochester? I mean, we don't have General Railway Signal anymore. We don't have R.T. French. We don't have Rigou. We don't have the majority of Kodak, Bausch & Lomb, Xerox, all these companies that provided a lot of jobs. And I followed with great interest Unite Rochester and the anti-poverty initiatives and everything. But it seems like, aside from raising consciousness and awareness of the problems, nothing happens. We don't get, you know, the Tom Golisanos here, the Annie Wegmans, you know, starting factories. So I just had that to say, and I'll take your answers off the air.
All right, Anthony, thank you. Go ahead, Ed.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks to the caller for that question. We did look initially at all of the racial groups that are tracked by the census, and we have some data in the appendices on all of those, including American Indians. The variations between people of color and people who were classified as white were so dramatic that we clearly focused in on that. But those groups that we did look at constitute over 95% of the region's population. So it's also true that while you probably would find some disparity similar among other groups, the numbers are so small that I'm not sure whether we could assume that that data would be good hard data. The Asian population is interesting. It's growing. We clearly have what I would call a bifurcated Asian population. There are more Asians living in the suburbs than there are in the city, which is certainly the difference, is different than any other of the groups out there. We have Asian populations that are very distinct, some that are very highly educated and some that are actually refugee groups and have different demographics. So while the Asian population only accounts for 2.5% of the region's total population, it is a growing number, and I think in the future we want to kind of focus on that a bit.
Okay.
The second question's a harder one for sure. The poverty initiative, I think, has been an excellent response by the community to the fact that data and other information was presented to people. Now, how you create action. Anybody that has a good idea on that should contribute it right away. But the truth of the matter is no community's ever done this. No community in the United States has ever achieved the goal that Rochester has set for itself. So the fact that it hasn't happened in 3 years since this work began is not exactly surprising. It's going to take longer. It's going to take the full 15 years of the time frame. And I think that the Poverty Initiative is right now at a very good phase to begin to start looking, now that it's done a lot of learning about what the next steps might be. And I think there's some good results that are going to come along soon.
I think in 2015, you told me on this program, I said, you know, if someone wanted to ask what's something that can be done to change things in 1 year in poverty, you said, sure, stop asking what can be done to change things in 1 year. That's one thing. Yeah. Just stop expecting results in a year. But 3 years in, we got an email from a listener named Emily who just wanted to know, does Ed think the Anti-Poverty Initiative is working? That's a broad question. But you seem to be more sanguine about this than others. I want to say others. There's plenty of people who are optimistic about what the Anti-Poverty Initiative is doing. There's others who have been involved in the political race who've been more critical this year. So far, you appreciate what you see from it?
Well, appreciate's a great word, because I think I do appreciate it. You know, I have my own frustration sometimes. I'm still very involved. I'm on the steering committee, and I'm involved in a lot of the work on one of the co-chairing the data evaluation team. So, you know, I get to see this firsthand. And yes, there are times I get frustrated. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? But the truth of the matter is as I said earlier, nobody's achieved success here in trying to do this at a local level anywhere. Probably the best example of achieving changes in poverty is what happened in Great Britain when they established some national policies to reduce childhood poverty and were successful. But they were national policies that are very different than the kinds of policies that exist here in the United States. And so how a local community makes progress against these huge issues in face of that national reality is a tough question. I can think of two approaches. One is the one we're doing, and the other is to do nothing. And between those two, I think what we're doing is much better.
You talked about the concentration of income over the years, at the top in this country, mm-hmm. which is tracked in many ways with economic concentration. And by that, I mean larger companies, less competition, more mergers. And there is some movement to push back. The anti-monopoly crowd has said that things got out of hand and that the inevitable result is that there you have the Amazons of the world and you have the big, big companies of the world that get the mergers. And they employ a lot of people in a few cities, but you don't have the mid-sized and smaller companies. You don't have the company, the cities that have, you know, either big manufacturers the way we used to, or even other sort of mid-sized employers. And you've got hollowed out communities, certainly in the Rust Belt and in even smaller areas, but even in the Rochesters of the world. And that you can talk all you want about fixing poverty, but until we deal with economic concentration, we're never going to see sort of a surge in jobs that will allow communities to rebound. Is this outside of your research? Do you have any feelings
on
that?
Well, it is outside the research. We did touch a little bit on the first report on, you know, the changes in manufacturing employment and the effects that might have had here. Rochester was hit pretty hard. Of course, most Northeast Midwest city states were hit pretty hard as well, and some have adjusted better than others, frankly. But that aside, you know, this is a tough time for the economy of the United States in the sense that products can be made on a global basis. They can be transported. I bought a product a few years ago, and I wasn't proud of myself buying it. I walked in to rent a product that I thought would rent for $200 a day, and I was told, well, you can buy it for $11, and I was shocked. So I bought it at a hardware store. I said, how the heck can you make this for $11? And they explained that it was assembled on a ship in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, where not even the loose labor laws of many of our competitors apply. And I thought to myself, my gosh, is that really possible? So, you know, we're in a world of global competition. The good news for the American worker, I think, and it's not really very good, is that other worlds are catching up, that other worlds' income are catching up. What's odd about all this, however, is that within the United States, that has not reduced the wealth of the upper levels, upper echelons of our society. Instead, they have grown considerably. So that's the big disconnect. It would be one thing to say, okay, we as a nation are now really subject to global competition, and it's hard, it's tough. We can't live the good life we lived when United States was able to ignore global competition. That would make sense if we didn't see some people getting remarkably rich in that context. So that's where the disconnect is.
Sure. And that doesn't address structural racism and some of the other factors that go into why there is this massive disparity. We're talking to Ed Doherty, the author of the report from ACT Rochester called Hard Facts, Race and Ethnicity in the 9-County Greater Rochester Area. And as Ed has said, in many of these categories, it is just unbelievable how much worse African-American and Latino households are doing in our Greater Rochester area compared to the country. That is not something to be proud of. As Ed has talked about in different ways, you can quantify how much that has hurt our region. And some of the other solutions. You told City Newspaper, quote, we have to find some way of improving public education, end quote. If you fix poverty, do you fix schools? Or do you have to fix schools first?
Well, that's an interesting question. I, in some of my talks, I lay out what I call four options for dealing with this nexus of poverty and education. One is to take the poverty out of education. What that means is that kids go to school where there's less poverty, regardless of where they live. The second is to take the education out of poverty, which means eliminating poverty, actually. The third is maybe there's some other way of educating people who are in classrooms as they are in Rochester, where there's 90% poor children. By the way, that's a majority of the elementary school classrooms in the city. That's not a few. That's the majority with 90% or more poverty. Clearly, education would have to look different there. I don't know what it is. I'm not an educator. But clearly, trying the same approaches aren't working. And then the fourth option is keep doing what we're doing and somehow expect different results. And that seems to be the option that we have chosen as a community for the last 50 years. We got to break that cycle. We have got to do it. And it's remarkable watching people like the Great Schools for All initiative, where they're focusing on a fairly modest approach to that, and that is to create a few region-wide magnet schools that would allow people from all areas of the community to attend, and the institutional kinds of resistance that exists to that. Now, a lot of credit to the group because they're continuing, and maybe we'll see some good success there. But we really, I mean, there's an adage in the education field right now that says you learn to read by grade 3. So that then you can read to learn in the rest of your academic career. It makes perfect sense. And yet, when we look at these numbers, we're getting single-digit proficiency rates in our entire region, mind you, not just in the city, for people of color. And certainly, if you break it down and look at what's going on within the city, you get some very similar kinds of results.
Single-digit.
Single-digit
third-grade
proficiency.
Reading proficiency.
That is correct. And you know, that's
we're that's not, a tragedy.
That's why I do focus on the concept that you can say anything you want to say about how you think housing should be arranged in our community and so forth. But this is the number one civil rights issue facing our community. That's my opinion. Is the inability of us to provide equitable educational opportunity. And so we need to find some way of really intervening quickly and dramatically.
From the data, would a Wake County-style approach work? I'm going back to the mid-70s when Wake County, North Carolina decided countywide schools. It was easier for them. They didn't have 19 school districts as Monroe County does. And again, we're talking 9 counties in the Rochester area. So let's just take Monroe County. They didn't have 19 or 20 school districts. They had an urban district and a suburban district. They had two. But they merged them with a 40% cap on essentially kids in poverty, free and reduced lunches. And so no school has more than 40%. There's a lot of busing that goes on to do it. They tried it 40 years ago now. And some of the folks with Great Schools for All told me, ideally, we could go back in time to the 1980s and get Rochester and Monroe County to do the same. And we're not going to do that. But does the data support that kind of approach?
Well, I think the data does support that. I mean, you know, Raleigh is certainly a more prosperous community than ours today. And they don't have the disparities. They have attempted to, in fact, enforce that concept that nobody would be in a school of more than 40%. It's never perfect in any given year, but it's pretty darn good as compared to what we have here. Difficult to implement even today, let alone this notion that we could somehow go back to 1979 and do it. That was a good opportunity, perhaps, to have considered it. But I am also of the belief that the option of reinventing our neighborhoods so that they are not neighborhoods where people can't get equal opportunity. In other words, creating neighborhoods where people can have equal opportunity is a very viable strategy. And I think that I actually ran a few numbers on this a few years back and said, what if we wanted to solve the problem doing one strategy? And any one strategy comes up with a number that is astronomical and almost impossible to grasp. But if you start looking at doing several strategies simultaneously, giving people opportunities to live throughout the community, improving areas within the community, eliminating poverty as best you can for everybody, then all of a sudden the numbers become far more achievable. So that's key. You can't just look for a panacea, but we need multiple sets of strategies if we really want to make a dent in this.
Rosie in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Rosie.
Hi, thank you. I apologize because I just started listening, and I'm not really up to date on what the Poverty Initiative is doing, but you talked about the families and children in poverty and the disparate numbers in the African-American Latino community. And I wondered what effort is being done to look at the correlation between those numbers and the family members or the missing family members of those families who are caught up with their interface with the justice system. And has there been efforts to affect, partner, and work with the justice system to come up with some solutions so that when these family members are back out into the community to ensure that they have opportunity, that there's incentives, corporate incentives, job coaching, training to keep them out of jail and in a position to contribute to their families.
Okay, Rosie, thank you. Go ahead, Ed.
We certainly believe that children of single parent households are a major category that needs to be concentrated on. 82% of the poor children in Rochester, in the city of Rochester, this is mixing a little bit, so I want to be clear. 82% of the poor children in the city of Rochester are from single-parent households. So clearly that is a group that requires some kinds of strategies. They're very challenging to come by. For people who are obligated to pay child support and are able to do so, that system's in place because those kinds of efforts exist, and there are systems that actually do result in child care payments being made by people who are employed. The caller specifically asked about people in the criminal justice system, and that gets much, much more complicated. And that is a part of our problem here. You know, John Klofas out at RIT studies this data better than anybody, and he has produced data that shows that about 3,500 people per year enter into the city of Rochester from the criminal justice system. That's a huge number, especially cumulative. That's every year. And so we looked a number of years ago at what kinds of services are available, and there are some good programs, but they're far from meeting the needs and far from achieving the kind of goals that the caller, I think, envisioned.
Assemblyman Mark Johns on the line with us. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, hey, Ed. How you doing?
Good, Evan. Assemblyman.
I just wanted to mention that I do something on a personal level, which we all can do. You know, we hear Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump talk about American jobs, but I actually help out by going out, and when I buy a new car, I buy an American car made in America. You realize that about three-quarters of the new cars that are sold are foreign cars, or they're transplants, which, you know, are in this country, but they're foreign-owned. So the profits and the money go overseas. I mean, think about that. We can say Black Lives Matter and we care about working Americans, but you know what? We have a choice. We're a pro-choice country. I bought a Buick, turned out to be the best car I've ever owned. It's unbelievable, 187,000, hardly burns any oil, still got original brakes, nothing ever goes wrong. But I not only got a quality car, I got a car made by General Motors in America, which provided good paying jobs for people in this country. You know, they happen to be union jobs, but I care about all workers, union and non-union. And to keep the country, to keep the money in the country, to keep the profits in the country, will help balance the budget, will help create good paying jobs. And guess what? The money that stays in this country is going to be used to pay people Social Security and Medicare and other programs, which at least keep the elderly out of poverty.
Mr. Assemblyman, let me ask you a quick question, though. Here is Kevin Williamson, a writer for National Review, a conservative writer for a conservative publication who recently wrote a piece saying Made in America doesn't mean what it used to be. He says about 80% of what goes into a Toyota Camry sold in the United States is made in the United States, which is a lot more than some, quote, American cars. About 70% of a 2011 Honda Civic was American made, while only about 2% of a Chevy Aveo from the same year was of North American origin. In other words, Toyota and Honda are doing a lot more American car making than some, quote-unquote, American cars. So do you really feel all that comfortable that your strategy is going to be the panacea, Mark?
Yeah, I do, because the fact is I know what content is in the cars. So when I buy it, mine happened to be close to 100% American. But I have a choice. I'll admit the Camrys are 75% American. I like that idea. But I do have a choice. I can buy a Buick Regal. You know, I can buy other comparable cars. I'm just saying, do you think the Japanese are going to pay your Social Security? Do you think the Koreans or the Germans are going to pay your Medicare? I mean, the profits leave the country. A lot of the pieces, parts, and components are made in other countries. The research and development is done in other countries. And I'm not saying this just calling up like some union shill. I'm calling up to talk about good-paying American jobs that stay here in America.
Right.
Now, when you take a I've seen people with Black Lives Matter and other different stickers on the back of foreign cars. You know what? We have a choice. And I think when you get a choice, if you can exercise it, I understand with suits and ties and pants and shoes, choice is pretty limited. But a big ticket item, go into Lowe's or go into Home Depot, you see Samsung, Gold Star, all these other countries now are producing cheaper products and sending them over here.
All right, Mark, I got to jump in and let Ed respond because I want to get a little bit more there. What do you think?
I can't dispute the value of people making those kinds of choices and decisions. I'm not sure that it's going to affect this question of disparity of income and race that we've talked about. That's an interesting question. I've never studied that. But it's certainly true that we all make choices, or at least we have some choices to make in how we spend our income.
And then there's folks like Casey in Rochester. Go ahead, Casey.
Is the soul gone? Is the soul dead? Is the spark gone? Where folks know that even without an education, they're still going to be taken care of, that they're still going to have food on the table and the rent is going to be paid and they're going to have all of the things that are going to be needed. So what's the point? What's the point of going through and getting an education? Very quickly, in regards to the Assemblyman's comment, union jobs. It's a fraction today of the union jobs that used to be because of robotics in these plants. And I dare you to say to take apart his Buick or his Oldsmobile and find that probably 80% of the parts that are in it are from other places around the world.
All right. Casey, thanks. He's saying, Ed, that families of color know there's a safety net and that kids are not motivated to achieve.
Yeah, well, I don't personally believe that. I think that my own experiences is if you look at a person in poverty, and you'll find some lazy people there. I'm not sure there are any more highly represented among people of poverty than people of non-poverty. It's just you know,
but
you can find
the
them, and you can choose to make that your stereotype. That we do have a system in New York that's a little bit more generous than some other places, but people should really read some of the welfare reform work that came out of the 1990s, because assistance is not as generous as people. We've studied this fairly deeply. Only about two-thirds of people in poverty actually receive assistance. It's remarkable that people choose or don't receive it for a variety of reasons. So I think those stereotypes don't hold up.
Unfair last question, because you only got 20 seconds. Are our political leaders failing or succeeding on this issue?
They have some work to do.
All of them?
Oh, certainly. I'm not pointing any specific fingers. And it is regional. This needs to be a regional political and leadership conversation.
The name of the report is Hard Facts, Race and Ethnicity in the 9-County Greater Rochester Area. Ed Doherty and ACT Rochester bringing that report. We're going to link to it so you can check it out in full. And Ed, I wish we didn't have to have these conversations, but thank you for illuminating these issues around our community, and let's continue the conversation.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate your keeping a focus on this.
Always good. Listeners, if we couldn't get you, thanks for calling, all the great interaction. We will talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.